overall consumption, especially by those of us living in the United States, is not only causing the collapse of our planet, it is threatening the survival of future generations. A few of our major hurdles, and there are many: inequality, inequity, war, natural disasters, political and economic injustice. What would it look like if we approach the solutions to these challenges through the lens of love? Just press pause for a minute and think about that. We have a dynamic, impactful, passionate guest with us today who is leading the vision of creating a diverse community of people who are not only addressing their immediate needs, but who are working for systemic change, real substantive change that moves the world in the direction of peace and justice. Hey, everybody, I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Impact Earth Spirituality. What better time and what greater need is there than to talk about that today with everything going on in our world? We're going to be having a conversation about using love to transform ourselves and the world moving towards peace and justice. Our guest is Reverend Mariama White Hammond. And from where I sit, I don't think there could be a more important, more meaningful, more critical conversation to be having, especially with the state of our country at this very moment in time, than with this woman, to hear her story and to give a nation at war with itself a possible path, or maybe even just a few steps to move in the direction of healing. Reverend Mariama, can you tell that I'm really excited about having you here and that maybe you showed up just because I needed you so much?
Well, I hope I have something to say about this. I can definitely share what I've learned along the journey.
I have no doubt. And I before we dive in, so to speak, I just want to kind of set the table, as they say, to remind our listeners that the very clear intention of the Impact Earth podcast series is to get the audience to understand the authentic viewpoint of a thought leader or a passionate person about their cause and who is then doing something to make a difference. We're not about raising awareness. These shows are supposed to be about inspiring people to act. We want to find out who these people are, how they show up in the world every day, and what they are doing to impact our planet and all of its inhabitants. Today's guests will not disappoint by any measure, I have no doubt. As I said, her name is Reverend Mariama White Hammond. She is an advocate for ecological and social justice, youth engagement, and spirit-filled organizing. She is the founding pastor of New Roots AME Church in Dorchester, Massachusetts. And New Roots is a multiracial, multi-class community that is innovating new ways of being a church. She is also active in numerous secular and interfaith justice efforts. For those efforts, she uses an intersectional lens in her ecological work, challenging folks to see the connections between immigration and climate change, or the relationship between energy policy and economic justice. So all of you who have been listening to me for a long time know I love this. And as if all of the above is not enough, the Reverend is a fellow with the Green Justice Coalition, which brings together 8 social/environmental justice groups from around Massachusetts. She speaks throughout the country and was the MC for both the 2017 Boston Women's March and Boston's People Climate Mobilization. So, Reverend, thank you for coming here and showing up for me and for all of us.
It's good to be here.
Okay, so I do have the first question. And when it comes to my introduction and honoring you to be here in these challenging times, it's always like, so where do I start? What do I ask first? But I really do have a clear direction on this one because of the way you tie things together when it comes to connecting climate change to energy and economic justice, and why, as citizens of the planet, those connections really matter, and if we do it, it's for the greater good. So let's start with, there's really a question in here, and I want to start with your why. Why do you think it's important to look through the lens of climate change at the intersection of social justice? What inspires you?
Yeah, so for me, it starts with what I actually think the challenge that we're facing is. So I think many people would say, oh my gosh, we have so much carbon in the atmosphere. Completely true. That is definitely a challenge. But for me, that is a symptom of a way of living that has really been cultivated over centuries that has culminated in the crisis that we see right now. And so if you start your analysis from, you know, at what point we cross 350 parts per million, then that's one way of looking at it. My analysis really starts back for me from the beginning of time. I look at the biblical text and some of the challenges that humanity has had with each other. And it's not just the Christian texts that name this. There are many different stories and each of them calls out some really deep challenges we've had in terms of living with each other and living in right relationship with the earth. So for me, the crisis that we're in is an outgrowth of the decisions we've been making over really the course of human history. And this is the natural outcome of not having gotten those things right. So I say my work is ecological justice. And that's not because I'm critiquing any other word or I care about environmental justice and climate justice. But for me, the root problem is that we have never learned to live in right relationship with each other. And we've never learned to live in right relationship with the other beings on this planet on who our lives depend. And so we're in a moment where that balance has got to change. We can't technologize our way out of this. We've got to change some fundamental things about how we operate. And so if that's what you see as the root problem, then the solutions cannot just be about parts per million in the atmosphere or carbon capture or any of those things. The solutions have to address the root problems. And I think a lot of these things are symptoms. The way we treat immigrants, symptoms of the way we do not know how to live in right relationship. The way we treat people who've made a mistake and find themselves involved in the criminal justice system. Which people get a second chance and which people get thrown in a cell and left to languish. The way we invest in our children or not. Whose children matter or not. All of these are connected to a basic challenge that we have of really honoring each other and living in right relationship with each other. And I think you framed it really well. We don't know how to love each other. The central tenet they ask in my text is they ask Jesus, you know, sort of what is the core of it all? And he says, love God and love your neighbor. That's really the core of it all. And again, there are multiple texts that frame it different ways. But at the end of the day, if we don't get that right, if we don't live in right relationship with each other, I don't see how we come out of this crisis. Because the truth is, and we're experiencing it right now, we haven't done when we needed to. The suffering that we are already experiencing is monumental. If we don't change, we not only won't mitigate climate change, we also won't make right decisions about how we take care of each other in these times. People are already suffering. There are lots of folks in California without homes. There are lots of folks right now in the Philippines who've lost everything in the rains and floods that are happening there. People are suffering. And if we use the ways we have up to this point of interacting with each other and living with the earth, oh my gosh, I don't even want to imagine the kind of harm we will inflict on each other. So climate is real. I care about it. I pay attention to the science. But for me, the problem that led to this is much deeper. And there so far must be the solutions.
And, you know, I could listen to you for another hour. And if you want to keep on that trail, it's like, okay, I'm just going to keep listening. Like I'm sitting there saying, yay, yay, yes, yes. But a couple of things that I want to reflect on that you said. Mm-hmm. This show, as with many shows, make me do the deeper cut. And I have found over the last 12 years, what our listeners want is to find themselves in the story. And I'm in your story. And it's not in all bright, happy, and cheerful kumbaya ways, which I really want to get to. But the overall need, desire, moral imperative for things to change could never be more evident. So when you talk to people about, oh yeah, like we have 350 parts per million of CO2, blank stares. It's like, I don't see myself in that story.
No.
Okay, personally. So you're saying, do you see yourself in this story? Do you see yourself in this neighborhood? Do you see yourself paying taxes to support these people that are in jail that never should have been there in the first place, let alone have a life sentence? Do you want to pay the taxes on that? So getting people to see in their story. So let's start with taking a step back for a minute, because this is what happened to me to put me in the story. Major healing has to occur in communities, family members, political leaders, every level of governing. But before we go there, before we can even get a vision for what that looks like, do you think that any steps have to happen before that healing can actually occur? Are we missing some steps? Do we have to acknowledge or...
Oh, yeah.
What's the playing field for me? Because it's not just about moving forward. It's about, can you take a look at where we are? Really, Gina?
I think we have to be honest. I mean, I think a lot of the pain and tension that we're seeing in our country right now is because some of us are asking for us to take a hard look at ourselves. There are so many beautiful things about this country. There is much to be proud of, but there is also a dark and highly problematic history that starts really from the beginning of the modern, you know, understanding of who the United States is. This weekend, I'm going to Virginia to see some of my family. Some folks have been, you know, not doing well health-wise, and we've decided that, like, now is the time. We don't, you know, COVID has made it hard, but we're going to go.
Right.
My family lives in a county across the river from Jamestown. We have to talk honestly about how my ancestors even got here. And even before that, how Native people were here living and are here, but were here living in a different and much better balance with the earth. And they were massacred in many instances. Now that I want to be careful because there are so many Native people still around, and there's almost a way in which we act like they've like all been massacred and don't exist. There are many Native people
right,
still here.
Right.
But we cannot deny that many, many, many communities were decimated, families were broken up, people were killed and then moved, made to walk across the country from where they had known to some other place. So I think that, you know, there's a tendency for some of the folks who don't want to deal with that to say, well, you know, every country does that. And that's why we're in the place that we are.
Yeah, that makes it all better.
You're actually somewhat true.
Right.
It is somewhat true that human beings, since the beginning of time, have been inflicting such shameful harm on one another. But that doesn't make it okay. And if we don't fix that, if we don't make it right, if we don't acknowledge it, how do we even begin to do something different? How do we begin to walk away from those ways of being? We can't move to a new way of being if we haven't been honest about our complicity in the way things are. So yes, there is a reckoning required. And the truth is, it's actually not going to be pretty. I am not shocked at all about the challenge that we are facing in this moment. I'm really thankful that the death of George Floyd has helped some people to wake up. It has helped our country to have some conversations we already should have been having. But I have no misgivings that we're just going to have a good, nice conversation about it and be able to move on. You're absolutely right. You know, there is work to be done, and that work will be painful. And I think anybody who's been through their own family healing process, right?
Right.
You know, there was sexual abuse in my family from my grandfather. He is passed on, and we are still struggling with it.
Right.
And I asked myself the question, where did he learn that? Because I know the people who are alive now. I know that that story probably starts before I even can imagine. And who, you know, so the reality is, this is hard work. Facing the truth is not easy. Uncovering it, but it's absolutely necessary, because you can't move in a new direction if you haven't really taken the time to assess, understand, figure out how you've played a role in the system as it is.
And, you know, one of the things that's hard for me, not hard, challenging, is the whole issue around white privilege. And we could go off on a 3-hour discussion about that.
Yeah.
We could, because someone like me, I know that I am going in the right direction, but I'm not fully aware of I would say there's, you know, breakdown, breakthrough. I'm not full breaking down. And for example, when I start saying the Pledge of Allegiance, and a lot of people won't like that I say this, and like, well, that, you know, maybe you should think about why you don't like that I'm saying this, but I can't say it anymore. One nation under God with liberty and justice for all, because it's never been. When I look at the White House, I'm like, oh my God, slaves built that. I don't feel the same. Mm-hmm. That's the process of me acknowledging what was all pretty and put in the nice table books, you know, coffee table books. So there's a process that people go in the right direction. I wear a Black Lives Matter pin. And the other day I was putting it on, and one of the voices in my head, the committee members, as I call them, said, who do you think you are wearing a Black Lives Matter pin? Really, Gina? And I put it on anyway, because I want to think about what that means to me, and how does that matter, and what am I saying about white privilege that I'm not even aware of? So let's go on to, it's a perfect segue to me about immigration, since, oh, by the way, except for those Native people, we're all immigrants. Mm-hmm. People don't remember that. I made it, so can they. So you connect immigration and the millions of refugees already displaced from their homes or being impacted by where they live to climate change. So can you walk us through how you can connect immigration to climate change?
Yes.
How are they connected?
So particularly, I've had the opportunity to visit with some communities in Mexico. Communities in like Chiapas and San Cristobal. There's other communities in Guatemala. There are communities in El Salvador. Communities where people have been farming the land for generations, passing it down one to another, passing the wisdom, bringing in the harvest, having whole festivals around it. And the challenge is that at this point, much of the wisdom that they've learned is, first of all, no longer fully applicable, because people can't rely on the weather to be what it has been forever.
Right.
It's not in my bio, because I'm sort of not feel like I can't call myself a farmer exactly, but in reality, I am a bit of a farmer. I'm part of a group of folks who are cultivating a farm in New Hampshire. And this year we had drought, and not knowing and trying to figure out our right farming system. And we are having to pay a lot of money to build a well, because we can't rely on the rainfall anymore. It's just not viable.
And that's really smart on your part. I mean, it's like, but nobody can.
It costs a lot of money.
Right, a lot of money.
So you have people who have lived for generations relying on the rainfall, that was, you know, timing their lives by that cycle, who can't do it anymore, because climate change has changed the game so much. I mean, the guy, you know, I met last week, last Thursday with the guy who's, you know, the rep for the Well company. And, you know, he said to me, he's getting so many calls because a lot of folks in New Hampshire rely on ground wells. They have forever. They fill up in the winter. You drink them through the summer and then they fill up again.
Right.
But this year they didn't fill up because there was not enough rain to sustain people. So this is not anything that we're not directly experiencing. The problem is that the average American, first of all, doesn't know anything about the rain cycle. Until I, started farming, I didn't check every day for rain. And I certainly didn't pray for rain, right? I wasn't like, yes, let it rain. Now I'm like, if it doesn't rain, somebody has to go water our crops. Right. You know what I mean? So I'm like, thanks for the rain. We, even those of us who may care about climate change already, if you don't live by an agrarian cycle, you don't feel it quite on the same scale that people are already experiencing it. So when you see millions of people coming to our borders, it's because they just can't live as they were able to for millennia in some instances. This is really destabilizing people's lives. And what do you do if you can't eat? Quite frankly, you figure out how you're going to do that.
Right.
Everybody is going to figure out how to make sure their children can survive. It's just basic. And you know, the rhetoric around like, these people are trying to take our jobs. These people are trying to feed their families and themselves. They're just trying to survive. And there will be many more. Because as it gets harder and harder, people will not have $13,000 to dig wells. That's not real.
No, it is not.
And so, you know, there is a deep connection. And that's not the only reason that people are coming to the border. We could talk about, there's a lot of nuance here. But when you look at the direct connection with climate change, it baffles me that the recalcitrance on some folks to do anything about it because, you know, we need to keep our fossil fuels alive. Well, go ahead. But you're going to have millions more people at the border if they can't eat.
No kidding. And when the rainforests are gone, which is happening, so scary. But let's keep on that path, because for me, and I had a conversation last week with someone about this topic. He's a nice man. I said to him, so Dave, and it wasn't Dave, our Dave, of course, because he wouldn't be on Mrs. Green's World team if he asked this question. But those people, I love that phrase. When that's a big red flag for me. Well, those people are blah, 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 blah. And I said, so Dave, I want to ask you a question. What would you do? And he's my age, so he has grandkids. I said, what would you do if your children and grandchildren were literally starving to death, and you as the patriarch or the head of the family, whatever you want to call yourself, not only were they being starved to death, but your granddaughters were in some cases successfully abducted by gangs, mm-hmm. in some cases successfully raped and left there, in some cases threatened and living in fear 24/7, and you had no food or clean water, what would you be willing to do? And Reverend, it stopped him in his tracks because he's really a good person. But that's what we have to be asking each other. Mm-hmm. What would you do? Where would you see yourself in this story? And that's what you're talking about. So when you hear the angst and vitriol and bitterness in my voice, this is where it came to be doing the deeper work for me. I was the head of the refugee program for Arizona from 80 to 85. And I say to people, and we didn't lose one child. We never had one child separated from their parents. And, you know, that voice comes out of me. And it's like, okay, that's a big red flag for me. But when I read about your work, when I clicked on some YouTube videos, I started calming down. Because the truth is, the deeper work is that I don't forgive the people who put six-month-old babies in cages. I don't think it's okay. I don't think it's their job and they were just doing what they were told. So I'm sitting in your church and I'm saying, yes, yes, you know, Reverend, you're so right. And then it's really, no, I don't like those people. I don't want them living in my neighborhood. I don't want them in my circle of friends. So I'm really not part of the solution yet. I'm still in the breakdown stage. I mean, I admit it. It's like, you know, screw that. Honest to God, not to be tacky, but I can get baited so quickly. And my, I will say, pretty much hate for those people is just as strong as there is. Theirs is, to me, Lucy liberal. You know, you're going to pay for everybody to get medical care and education, and you're going to give away the farm. So if you peel back the layers, I'm not part of the solution yet. And you are.
Well,
you are. So you have to.
Not every just, day.
That's
not
good. Every, oh, God. She's human. Can we press pause?
I have days.
She's human. When I interviewed the Reverend Michael from Agape, we had the same conversation. I said to him, do you ever had a bad day? And after he got over laughing, he said, well, I happen to know the Dalai Lama, and even he has bad days, Gina. And that kind of stays with me a little bit. He's a work in progress. So,
oh, we all are.
I'm glad to know that. I know. But, you know, some of us are higher a little bit on the evolution chain. And I'm trying to get there, mm-hmm. to get constructive, to sit in the same room with those people. So how do you help me? How do you help people that are coming to you, looking to you, that really in their hearts want to move forward? Mm-hmm. And I've been having deep conversations with a friend of mine who, up until last week, was a diehard Republican. And his sister is one of my best friends. She gave him Michael Cohen's book. She said, Jack, here's how Donald Trump treats his friends. And I, you know, let's pick on him because he's like the easiest target in the world if you're me. But Jack is a loving, caring, kind, considerate. He's one of the kindest people I know. Mm-hmm. And it's what he learned. And he's thinking about it. He asked me about, you know, this ladder speech I used to do about, you know, I made it, so can you. And I'm like, yeah, if you didn't make it, shame on you because of everything you were born with. So I don't want to get off on my rant. There really is a question here, but what do you say to people like me sitting there that, you know, on both sides that want to do the right thing, that don't want this vitriol, this divisiveness? Give us a couple of how-tos.
Yeah. So the first thing that I think is when we talk about the heart of this problem, the first is the idea that there are those people and my people.
I know, that's terrible.
That so much violence has been committed because of that.
Right.
And so for me, it is starting off by recognizing that that way of being,
yeah, it's not going to get us there.
It's dangerous. And it's dangerous for all of us. For all of us. And so I got to push back on that. Anytime I find the those people kind of mentality in myself, I have to push back on it. That doesn't mean I'm successful every day.
Right.
But it does really start from a notion that that way of thinking is bankrupt. It's never good. It never turns out well. And so that doesn't mean that knowing that makes it easy to just shift. But I do. It's one of the things I say to people. I'm against all forms of nationalism. I don't care what epithet you put in front of it. I'm against white nationalism. I'm against black nationalism. I'm against Zionism as Jewish nationalism. I'm against all forms of nationalism, because they are about who is in and who is out. And I believe that that way of thinking is at the root of every atrocity that has been committed by humankind. So that's the first thing. I think the second piece is I started to really say, anytime I can't, like, it's so bad that I can't connect with that person, or I can't see that person's humanity, doesn't mean I endorse everything people do.
Right.
So I think that there's an important difference between people's basic humanity and the things that they do. I may hold you accountable for the things that you do. I may have to go up to the governor's office and push, But I try in my work to always be inviting people into a deeper level of love. So I'm here because the policy you've made is not loving. But I'm also here to invite you into a deeper level of love. Now, I just really don't believe at a fundamental level, people wake up in the morning and say, how do I ruin these people's lives? Okay, so there's a small number of people out there, right?
Yes, I think so. I believe that now.
Who are like, you know, serious white supremacists or other sorts of things. Now, how you get to that, I think, is from a place of deep brokenness. And that, you know, we could talk about that. But I think the average person doesn't wake up in the morning and say, I am trying to be racist today. I am trying to dehumanize Black people today. That doesn't mean that they don't end up in it.
Right.
But it's not, I separate people's direct intention from their behavior. And I try, again, I'm, you know, to hold their dignity and worth separate from, like, all humans, and quite frankly, for me, beyond humans, have dignity and worth. And I will respect that regardless of what you say to me and who you are, because that is my fundamental belief. And quite frankly, you know, and this is true, this may be a little bit of one-upmanship, I will not allow you to move me from that path. Because this is my path. I choose my path. I choose who I want to be. And I will not let you goad me in to being someone other than who I choose to be. And sometimes that makes it a little easier for me when somebody really pushes it and you really feel like the best thing would be just to tell them off.
Right. Right? Or punch them in the face, but, which I've never done.
But I'm like, I will not allow you to push my buttons. I've decided who I'm called to be and I will hold to that no matter who you are. And so I think that sometimes for some of us, we may need to couch it in our own stubbornness.
I love it.
To help us hold on to, I will be who I intend to be today. I don't care who you are. You will not move me off my path. And then if you do, I do offer myself grace, because there are definitely some people who I'm just like, you are very skilled at moving me off my path.
Yeah. I love that.
But
you baited me and I took the baits.
Yep.
It's what happens.
But most of the time I try to hold. I try to say, who am I being today? There's a couple people, like a couple of electeds, when I go to meet with them, because we've had some challenging calls, I have to spend more time in prayer. I remember we went to meet with this official who has some very challenging views around race. And by the end of the meeting, he's yelling, I'm yelling. And we left. And I said to my folks, I'm really sorry. I didn't spend enough in prayer time this morning around this meeting. And next time I will not show up to this meeting without at least spending a good chunk of my prayer time specifically focused on my behavior in this meeting. Because you could hear us down the hall.
I probably would have been loving it, sitting there getting it out. But I would just like everybody to, as Brené Brown loves to do, say, just press pause for a minute and listen to the words of wisdom that we just heard. Just press pause for a minute. Like, if you're listening on your phone or on your iPad, press pause for a minute and say, how does this apply to my life? How does what the Reverend just told us give me a tool, or does it? And for me, you gave me one already. And I'm really concrete about it. When I start saying the words, those people, it's going to start coming out like the those people, because I am going to work on pressing pause. And it's similar to when I worked with women who were victims of domestic violence, or survivors of, which is a better way of saying it. And they would say, well, it was my fault. I got him all upset. Usually it's a he. And, you know, what the trained social workers say, no, everybody's in charge of their own body. And if somebody beat you up, it wasn't anything you did, because that's never okay. So it's owning our own stuff and still working on finding the tools to go forward. Because if you remember what I said in the beginning, using love to transform ourselves and the world, moving toward peace and justice. And that's what I want to do. And I think there are a lot more people out there that I would call those people who want the same thing as I do.
Yep.
We just need a path forward.
And I think the thing is that there's the way we engage right now, we actually never get to hear
ever
where people really are. So I think there were maybe two other things I would say around how we engage in that. So I actually seek out those conversations. Every once in a while, I have a day where I'm like, given what else has happened to me today, let's not seek out those conversations. But when I am in places and spaces where that's possible, and quite frankly, as an example, I've begun a long-term relationship. I think it's at the beginning of something beautiful with the farmer who sold me garlic seed this year. Our first conversation, he mentioned that, we were figuring out when to come pick it up. And, you know, I was saying about COVID and I wanted to be careful because I had a fever. It wasn't COVID as it turned out. But the point is, you know, I wanted to respect. And he said, oh yeah, COVID's going to be over as soon as the election is over because it's just a political ploy. And I was like, okay, you know, and I didn't say anything right then. But later on, I shared with him that like people in my congregation have almost lost their lives. I've held prayer meetings as we, you know, pray that people are going to survive. So, you know, it is what it is. I didn't tell him you are hurtful or any of those things, but I needed him to see that like I have a lived experience with this that you're negating. And I don't need you to say at the end of it, you're right, I'm wrong.
Right.
I don't actually push for that.
Yes.
What I want you to hear is my lived experience, which you really can't necessarily challenge. Like there's very, you know, few people who, if you speak from your lived experience and from your vulnerability, not from your like one-upmanship, but your true like vulnerability, that they will just keep pushing. And he didn't. Now, I don't know. Maybe he still believes it's all a hoax,
right,
and I'm an idiot, you know, but like we came to a place where he did not bring that up again. He listened to what I said. He heard me about like, you know, the people that I know, and maybe he has changed. Maybe he hasn't. But I think that, you know, how do we have conversations for authentic understanding? How do I lean in and say, I'm really trying to understand where you're coming from? And if you feel like you need to push back, how do you push back from a place, not of your opinion, but of your lived experience? And that, I think, breaks through much more and opens dialogues and conversations. So I won't say his name on the air, but he knows who he is. You know, we've been talking about books we're going to share back and forth.
Right.
I'm sure that those books will come from different frames, but this is a real opportunity. And we both love garlic.
The common ground.
And he's teaching me stuff about how to, like he showed me how he gets his seeds in the ground. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's so much easier than what we're doing. I'm going to use that for next year. So, I mean, we do build, I do think it helps me that I am a pastor. I think it helps me build with some folks who may be a little bit more religiously conservative, that for whom Jesus becomes a starting point for us, even if we understand Jesus's life and mandate a little different. We are starting from some shared text and other sets of things. And I really try to lean into what do we have in common? But part of this also, Gina, is, you know, when I think about my life, how often did you make deep changes in your life because somebody came and yelled in your face or because someone told you were an idiot?
Right.
Like, I don't remember going, you know what? Thank you for telling me I'm stupid and I don't know anything. I'm going to go off and change.
Right. Doesn't happen.
The conversations that have shifted me were people that I knew came from a place of love often, but told me something hard. Because I did actually want to consider that. And so I think it's far more effective. I don't do it simply as a communication strategy. But if you want to evaluate from that perspective, if I'm serious about wanting people to shift, and that is some of my hope, I've got to use an approach that has a chance in hell of working.
Right, right.
I tell my, you know, young people all the time, I love you, but when was the last time your parents came at you and you were like, you're right, let me change in a different way? So why are you going at them with a strategy that wouldn't work with you?
Yes. And it reminds me of a story on this journey, which has been nothing but enlightenment, breakdown, breakthrough, move forward, examine something else. How is that connected? A friend of mine who will probably be a friend forever, I went to meet with him as a prospective sponsor, and he works for Bosch. And we sat down and someone else, you know, mutually beneficial friend had set us up. And he said, well, you're probably not going to like me very much. And I said, why would you say that? And he said, because I'm a hunter. So think about the synapses. It's like, bum, 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 bum. He made a judgment about me. And when he said that, I said, well, do you want to know what I think about hunting as an environmentalist? That it's critical, crucial, and if you don't do it, you're living a nightmare in New Jersey where deer are, you know, there's 10 deer in your front yard every day. So no, that's a stereotype. And we evolved into having some really tough conversations, like about the killing of wolves. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, you just don't know the ranchers, what they're putting up with. And my friend's a rancher. And I'm like, will you read a book? So the things that you said are tools that we can have mm-hmm. to invite people. It is about finding common ground. And sometimes that is harder for me than others. And he read the book. It's called Wolf Nation. And he called me up. He said, boy, did you knock me for a loop? Because it was told from the perspective of people that had found common ground, of ranchers and farmers and the wolf lovers coming together. And it's one, what I would call, not necessarily a victory, but a step forward towards that peace that you really hold as the light for us to be working for. So if I may, I just don't want the time to run out without us talking about like this very practical conversation about how do you connect energy mm-hmm. and energy policy and power plants, which is happening today in our country, with climate change and at-risk marginalized communities? And I hate even saying marginalized communities because that's such a euphemism for all the ugliness that implies. It's a much deeper cut than marginalized communities. It's just a way we sugarcoat things. So you had an aha moment. And see, I do my homework. In 2016, when you said, oh, this is an energy policy, this is going in this neighborhood. So can you share that moment with us and how it impacted your work going forward? Because I think it's really important.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that first I'll say, you know, I grew up in an environmental justice community. I didn't always know that. And I think that's true for many, many of us. We grow up in the reality that we have and never, sometimes don't consider it could be different. But I think that, you know, the story of my involvement with the pipeline here in Boston has actually got a couple of twists to it. And I'll try to tell it in the quickest version possible, which is
take your time. You know, take your time.
So energy policy clearly has deeply impacted and mostly negatively impacted Black communities. We are almost always the ones slated to get the dirtiest, most polluting of everything.
Lowest paying.
Yep. All of these power plants are often in Black and Latino, South Asian communities, and folks are really struggling. So I know so many people who have asthma. I know so many communities where that's just like a thing. My goddaughter has asthma. You know, it's just like almost a price we pay for our existence in this country, unfortunately. And it's actually not even just here. They're all around the world. Power plants are sited in places where we are the most. That being said, there was in 2016... Maybe in 2015, I got a call about some folks who were organizing around a fracked gas pipeline going into the community of West Roxbury. Now, to give a little context, I grew up in Roxbury, and there is no real deep relationship between West Roxbury and Roxbury. In fact, we don't even touch, so I'm not even understanding exactly how we became, you know, Roxbury and West Roxbury, since there's no, like there's a number of communities between the two.
Right.
Anyway, point being, people were resisting this fracked gas pipeline that was coming into West Roxbury. West Roxbury is the seat of power in the city of Boston. It's where multiple mayors have grown up. It's, you know, where the sort of almost resegregation of our schools movement has has blossomed. It's, you know, it's challenging, right? And so when they called me, I was like, I'm not coming out for a fracked gas pipeline in West Roxbury because they'll be fine. They'll figure it out. They always do. The politicians always come on their side. You know, they had all these people that were like fighting with them. And, you know, I was like, I have other things I need to work on in communities that don't have the same amount of power as West Roxbury. But they kept calling me. And, you know, it's like people that I know and asking me to come speak. And so finally I was like, okay. Like that, you know, don't be like that. You'll just go and participate at least one time. And there you go. You know, what became really real is, once I saw the pipeline, and again, I'm no engineer, but it was massive. And I was like, who thinks it's a good idea to put this in a neighborhood? You know, there's senior citizens homes along this route. It's like underneath a soccer field. I mean, I was just like, this is a like genuinely easy thing to figure out how problematic this is. You don't need a deep environmental analysis to know that having something this big, I mean, the pipeline was humongous, underneath the road is not safe. And to make it even worse, it's transfer station where, you know, so it's like some of the repairs can happen, is across the street from a quarry, like an active quarry, like where, you know, a couple times a week, the alarms go off and people's like, you know, the people who live along there, you know, you don't put pictures on the wall or you like basically like, you know, ding them all the way into the wall because the explosions from the quarry cause your pictures to fall off the wall. That seems like a stupid idea for where you put a highly flammable product like fracked gas. So for me, it was this moment where I was like, we're getting so crazy in our policy that we're not even just putting this in like low-income communities of color. We're also like willing to risk the lives of like middle-class black, white communities to keep up this policy. And so, you know, I got involved and probably one of the most powerful days where all of those connections came through was on my, there was a group of clergy, they were choosing a day to have another rally. And they chose my birthday.
Oh my God, a message from the universe.
I know. And my birthday, every year, I think about a young person who was involved with my program, Kareem Burry, brilliant young person, real like DJ and artist and really like the kind of young person that just really saw the connections. And I really saw him as a young leader. And unfortunately, in 2005, he was killed 2 o'clock in the morning on my birthday, not far from where I live, less than a couple miles. So that day is always a day of celebration.
Right.
But I never have my birthday without thinking about him. It always makes me think about all of the wasted talent that is brought about by racism, by poverty, by unjust criminal justice policies. Like I can't not think about it because I always think about the fact that he's not there. And so on that particular day, I found myself with other clergy in a ditch. And we started it with a frame from an article we had seen that the grave diggers in Pakistan were digging graves early because the heat wave the previous year had been so bad they were not able to get people in the ground in accordance with like Muslim tradition around how quickly you need to bury people. So they were pre-digging graves. And when you look at the picture of those pre-dug graves, they look the same size as the ditch for this pipeline. And the deep connections between what was going on in Pakistan, what was going on in West Roxbury, and the reasons that we'll never see Kareem on this side of the world again. And so it was a really powerful connection because, again, as I say, the problem isn't just the parts per million in the atmosphere. It's about how we are with each other and our lack of value. If you can't value your own species, how do you value the trees? How do you value the birds? If you would pollute water, which you absolutely need to live, what kind of people do that? What kind of society doesn't give a crap about its young people?
Right.
And so I think for me, that energy policy and the decision to put that dangerous pipeline right there in the middle of community in a way that had never been done it before. Usually they cite these things in rural communities so that, you know, sort of not as many people are close to them. It's just about us not being in right relationship and are just making boneheaded decisions that make no sense for like our future. And, you know, it's like people say stuff like, oh, we can't afford it. Oh, you know, we can't afford to save humanity. I mean, right. What right. else are we here for?
That's right.
We're going to eat that money. You're going to drink that money. Like, no. If you don't have water,
we're all toast. It's that rewiring of the brain. Because I crack up when I tell people about, you know, why you should eat these specific vegetables organic, and they say, "Oh my God, it's so much more expensive." As they are in line at a coffee shop paying $7 for their latte, and if it's a good friend, I say, "Really? Like, do you want to have this conversation with me? Because do you know how much kale that $7 would buy? Organic kale?" So it's those things. But the delightful part of you and your coming into my path at a time when I needed it, and here's the, you know, the emotions coming up, is part of my walk in saying, let those emotions come up. We are going to be shedding some more tears in the future if we are going on this path. And yes, it has to do with the marginalized community because we're all one people and climate change does not discriminate. It's one of the only things I know in the world that does not discriminate against rich, poor, middle class, racists, highly evolved thought leaders, people who are woke. Climate change, it knows no boundaries, and we're finding that. The good thing that can come out of the fires in the California are, yes, it even burned those rich white people's homes down. So when I say that, I'm thinking, those people, that's what I did. I just caught myself. So before I give my two cents at the end, is there anything else that you'd like to end with, to have us land on, before I hopefully do credit to this amazing hour that we spent together? Is there something you say, I wish Gina had asked me that?
Well, I will just say this, and you know, people do ask me, I guess my whole life, I've looked at the system that we have and always felt like we could do better. And I think what stops so many of us is the belief that this is the best it can get. And I think we can do better. And so I do think some of what we have to do is cultivate in ourselves a belief that something better is possible. And this, I think this pandemic has given us an opportunity to see the fragility of our world and say, you know what? Let's not settle for this. Like, I'm not going back. I am not going back to what was before this.
Me either.
Because we can do better than that. And that, I think, for me, is the beauty of this moment, the invitation to believe we can do better and to lean into that work. And so I want to note that I find so much joy in this work with people who say, how can we do better? Let's experiment. Now, let's just be real. You will fail. You will try some things. It will not work out.
Right.
You know, that, you know, so don't, you know, I'm not saying it's going to be like all kumbaya and perfect, but, what the heck else are you doing if you're not trying to change the world?
Love that.
Like, that's what else is more important that you just don't have time?
That's a bumper sticker
for it.
What could be more important?
And so I am so excited to build with, learn from, try new things with other people who are also saying, you know what? There is no time like now to start trying to build a better world. So I hope people will lean into having fun, being willing to put themselves out there, make mistakes, build community with people they never imagined or didn't know, and constantly doing our work as an invitation to everyone to join us. We will need to muster all of the ingenuity of humankind to save ourselves. So we shouldn't leave anyone behind. There is no one who lacks value. And I just think in some ways, yes, we are in deep peril. And I don't know if I'd want to be alive at any other time. If we get this right, can you imagine the stories that are going to be told about us? Like, I sometimes when I'm feeling down, I actually spend the time to imagine the stories. Like, let me open myself in this moment to what is possible, what could happen on the other side of this, so that I can find the courage to keep pushing on the days that I feel like I'm losing. But there is so much opportunity to radically shift our world to a better place. And I think my advice to us all is keep cultivating in yourself the recognition that we can do better. Keep dreaming and imagining and telling stories and weaving possibilities so that we can get to the other side of this. It's important to know the facts and everything, but if you lean too much into the reality that we're in, you will find yourself overwhelmed. So make sure that you cultivate a practice of possibility, because if you don't do that, you're gonna be depressed and overwhelmed. But if you do that, you're gonna see new possibilities. I'm a little into sci-fi. I do read a lot of sci-fi, futuristic books. Octavia Butler's my favorite author, because it opens up possibilities and allows me to see what we could be doing, the stories we could be telling, and to keep going.
Wow. So what I usually do at the end of the podcast is, you know, kind of wrap it up and put it all together for what happened to me during this very intentional listening. And I'm not going to do it, because what I'm going to invite our listeners to do is the same thing I'm going to do. Keep this podcast handy. I'm going to have to, because as I was preparing, I thought about it, Reverend, that we're recording this on October 27th. November 3rd is going to be one of the most critical days in American history for my time being alive. And what I'm hoping for is a blue wave. I'd be a hypocrite to not say that. But what I'm also hoping for, because of you, and I wrote these words down when you were talking, when I grow up, I want to be like Reverend Maruyama, is regardless of that outcome, we have to move towards peace and justice for everybody's sake. So you are inviting us to do that. We're all on the human walk this time around. So I'm saying more than I wanted to, but what I'm inviting people to do is press play, rewind, press play, rewind, and really take into your hearts the message that we were so blessed to get today. I got it, and I needed it so much, especially on this day. So thank you for showing up in my life and helping me recognize some triggers, like those people. When I say those people, it's a big one. It's a big red flag. And regardless of the outcome of the election, this podcast will air on November 10th. And if, what I would have said before I interview, if we win, one of the most important steps we need to take is inviting people who didn't to the table so we build this together.
Yep.
We need to have people sit down together and find that common ground like you are with your garlic farmer. And I hope he listens to this podcast so much.
Maybe I'll send it to him. I'm sure he'll tell me it's socialist, which is not a compliment from him.
I'm going to send it to my friend who says, oh yeah, those race baiters. And I'm like, Dave, what the heck are you talking about, race baiters? What do you even mean by that, dude? So thank you. Sincere, heartfelt, very, very warm, sincere thank you for showing up in my life. And Kelly told me she was quitting working for Mrs. Green's World and going to join your army. And I said, well, that's fine, Kelly, because I said at first, I'm going too. So we've been having some really fun conversations about this. So thank you so much. And I hope that you will help with distributing this, not to help our numbers, but to help with the healing of the planet. We're going to do our best to get high listens because we need it. So thank you. And everybody, you know, my last word is always to thank you, our listeners, because without you, there would be no us. Thank you, Reverend.
Thank you.